Well, you guys, I cannot wait for you to listen to this episode. I just interviewed a woman named Christina, who I actually met at an HA meeting. I was leading a meeting and she spoke with me afterwards and she had just, you know, she had like 30 days clean or something. And then I temporarily sponsored her. And I guess I told her at the time, I think I owned the studio and maybe I had some other sponsees, and then she found a different sponsor. And I've followed her progress on Instagram and on TikTok. And she also, you know, is doing the recovery content thing. And I knew she was still, you know, clean. And she is tapering down from methadone and has made a lot of progress during that methadone taper. And I thought, well, I would love to interview her. You know, the methadone taper is something I would like for people to know about, that that's really an option. And I didn't know a lot about the rest of her story. And her story is incredible. What she has survived is incredible. I am so impressed. You're going to hear me tell her multiple times throughout the interview. I'm so impressed that she lived, that she made it, that she got out of where she was. She was stuck in Hawaii for 10 years. Her parents sent her to a rehab there, a long-term behavioral modification rehab for 3 years. And she left and then stayed in Hawaii for another 10 years. And she was trafficked by someone to do sex work, and a lot of traumatic violence happened. And also, please be aware while listening, we do talk about sex trafficking, we do talk about assault, we talk about termination of a pregnancy. So please take care while listening and know that some of those subjects are going to come up. She, like most addicts, is a hilarious storyteller and tells her story vividly and with a lot of humor. And she now has over 2.5 years clean and sober. She lives with her boyfriend, who is also in sobriety. She now works in recovery at a treatment center and is thriving in her life. And at the very end, I spoke with her for so long that she suddenly realized she needed to be at work and was like, oh my God, I have to go. So the interview just finishes, but we get there, which is that she's on a successful methadone taper from 170 down to 20. She's got 20 weeks to finish and is wanting to get off because they want to start a family. And so she's on her way to finish that taper. She is involved in 12 step. She found someone that sponsored her, which, by the way, guys, I know a lot of times if you're on mat and you go to 12 step, you're going to take some shit. She has taken some shit, but she's also found someone to sponsor her and a group of women in 12 step that's really worked for her. So I encourage you, if you're on methadone, please look around until you find someone that will work with you, or Suboxone, because you will. It's not going to be right away. It's not going to be like if I walked in with 30 days and wanted to sponsor, you know, people are like, sure. You know, use your discretion when you share that you're on mat when you go to a meeting. You know, listen to somebody talk for a little while first and don't stop with the first person. If you ask them to sponsor you and you tell them that you're using Suboxone or methadone and they say no, you ask somebody else. So it's totally possible to find support in the 12-step community while on mat. Not necessarily easy, but possible. And I encourage you guys, please go follow her Instagram. Please go follow her TikTok. It's MajorChristina1989. On all platforms, linked in the show notes, and you can catch up with her life now, because basically that's what I was going to talk about. You know, you guys know how I do it. At the end, we just say like, great, what does your life look like now? And so you can catch up with her life now on Instagram and TikTok. Also, I would love for you guys to support her and follow her. She really wants to do the recovery content thing too, and she has earned a spot in the space. She has earned a spot, and I would really like for you guys to follow her. Whew, I was so moved by her story. I'm like, just kind of sitting here. I'm so moved by her story. I hope that you guys like it. It's an honor to be able to listen to people. She does say a couple of times that's the first time she shared about a lot of this stuff. And I feel proud of our community, the Nod Pod community. We've created a space where, you know, a lot of these women in particular, they'll listen to the show first. And of course, we get the details and we like to laugh and stuff, but they want to come somewhere where they know it's going to be like a supportive space and they feel that way with us. And that's not just me doing that. That's the community, because the energy of the podcast takes on the energy of the listeners. And you guys contribute to this being a safe podcast for guests to come on and share their stories. And it's important because you'll hear me say in the episode that in 12 step, their whole thing is often, we don't share the details because we all know what that looked like. Here's the solution. We don't need to get into the details. And I think that that's appropriate and that's worked for 12-step, totally. But I also think that it's good to have spaces where we do share the details, because I guarantee you there might be someone listening who has had the same situations. And if you were her, you would think, bro, like, you look at me, you got your 9 years now and you're running your studio. Like, you could not have walked in my shoes and gotten there. And she's right. I didn't walk in her shoes, but somebody else hopefully will hear her. And that has been where she's been and say, oh, you can have this happen to you and then get a life and be done and have a family. Like, that's why we share the details. I think it's important. So anyways, please let me know what you guys think about this episode. I really think you're going to like it. And yeah, love you guys. See you next week. I'm so excited to have you here. I'm really happy.
Me too.
And I loved your video that you made. That was so cute. And I thought it was really cool too to say, like, because like so much of that stuff happened to me where I would be like, man, I would love to live there one day. And then like I did, you know, or I'd be like, man, I should own this studio. I'm better at it than the owner. And then I did. You know what I mean? Like, and when you're a drug addict with 30 days and you have hopes like that, it feels so stupid, you know? It feels so stupid. Like,
it feels
out of reach. Sure. And it's embarrassing to even have the thought, right? Like, I remember my dad visited me once. Do you know FRC in Oceanside? So a lot of the girls around here go there. It's for women and children, but they let me go because I knew like the program manager, and I was there in 2014, and my dad flew out here to see me. And my dad is like my favorite person on earth. And he's like super successful. He's like this great man, raised two families, made all this money, has a master's degree in aeronautical science, like great guy. And he flew out here to see his derelict fucking daughter. And we were walking on the pier in Oceanside to go get a milkshake at Ruby's. And on the way back, I was like, so yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe one day I could like do fitness, you know, like fitness for people in recovery, you know, like, I don't know, like write a yoga program for drug addicts. And he was just nodding and he was like, yeah, that sounds good. And I'll never forget. I was like, shut the fuck up. You're not going to do any of that, you know? You're a homeless person. What are you feeding this man and yourself? I was so embarrassed, you know, but I did. I totally did a yoga program at SCRC later and owned a gym, and they would bring guys in rehab there, you know? And I just,
that's
right.
Awesome.
And so like, that's when I loved your video, because a lot of drug addicts have dreams at 30 days and it's embarrassing almost, you know? And I wish I had known, don't be embarrassed. You might do that. You might do that. So just, it's fine.
This is like proof that God knows our life beforehand, because we've met, what, almost 3 years ago? It's been like almost 3 years since we've met. I definitely was only a few days clean when I met you, really high on methadone, 170 milligrams. And you were the leader. Yeah. You were the leader that told your story. And I was like, and I went up to you afterwards and I asked you to be my sponsor, because I was like, wow, she's actually been through everything that I have. And you had a lot of sponsees and were super busy, so you were my temporary sponsor for a little bit. But I just remember like listening to your podcast that night and going, wow, I wonder if I could ever be on that. And immediately I'm like, bitch, shut the fuck up. You're probably going to relapse in 6 months.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And so that's why I love that. I love that, because I wish I had known. I don't know. I just doubted myself so much. And so I love that that was, you know, the video that you made. So why was I only your temporary sponsor? I had a bunch of sponsees or something, because I don't remember. And now I kind of feel bad. I'm like, oh my God, because I'm not a great sponsor. In fact, my sponsor has told me, she's like, I think that you can serve better in other ways. She straight up told me that. And she's like, and if you want to pass people on to me, you can. And your service areas can be in other ways. She fucking told me that shit, dude, because like I'm not a great sponsor.
I don't know if I'd be a good sponsor either, honestly. I still have not finished my steps, but I'm getting through.
So I finished my steps. I think the issue with me is when I owned my studio, which I would have when we met, I was so stressed out and so busy that what I would ask people to do is call me once a week at a set time. And then text me every other day. And if there was an emergency, say, hey, I feel like using. But like that doesn't work for a lot of people, because they want to be able to talk to you daily and get to know you. And like I had cleared that plan with Rachel, and she was like, yeah, you can do that. You can have a set time. Like you're a business owner. There's a lot going on. My husband was using. There was a lot happening. And she was like, you can do that. But then I felt so guilty because I have access to my sponsor all the time. And so I was like, you know what? I don't know that this is right. you know? So anyways, I feel like I wasn't the best.
You were like good vibes and you were so nice. And, you know, you told me that you were super busy. And with, I remember your studio and, okay, and then the podcast and everything. But I do remember going home that night and telling my mom, because I was still living at my parents. I was like, Mom, and she listened to an episode with me. I forget, but we listened to the whole thing together. And she was like, wow, that's amazing. And I showed her a picture of you. She's like, oh my God, she's so pretty. And I was like, yeah, she used to be a homeless junkie.
That's awesome. Well, good. I'm glad that I was nice. I'm glad that I was nice. That's good. That's good to know. So,
totally.
Okay. So I know that you are, and I'm going to leave all that in, by the way. I'll just start with that conversation because that's great. So I know you ended up in Hawaii. I'm so excited to talk to you because I've been watching your journey on TikTok and on Instagram for a while. Of course, I remembered you. You know, I remembered you from that meeting. And I'm so proud of you because you do. I meet a lot of women that I lead and they come up to me and they're like, they're on a bus from a program and I don't ever see them again. Or they post three more times on Instagram. I never see them again, you know? And so the few that I see, I'm like, damn, dude, she fucking stayed clean. Look at this one. She's clean, you know? And so like, I'm so excited to talk to you and learn more about your story and how you've managed to do this, because I know that your story is super, super gnarly, which are my favorite stories. The ones like mine, we lived outside for a long time. You know what I mean? Like sharing needles with homeless people, the whole nine. So I know that you ended up in Hawaii. How do you get to Hawaii? Yeah. 'Cause you're from San Diego.
I'm from San Diego. I'm from Rancho Penasquitos. It's right by Poway.
Okay.
I went to Westview High School. I barely graduated. I was already using meth. But let's just say that from high school to the little bit of college I did, I tried like six different rehabs. I went to Serenity twice. I went to some the detoxes around here. And I just couldn't do it. So my parents were like, you know, there's a rehab in Hawaii that's 3 years long. It's called Habilitat. It is a behavior modification rehab. So it would be similar to something like Crash.
Whoa.
Like, you know, Crash.
I do.
And how they yell at you and put you down and make you do weird fucking chores for hours and like they punish you and shit. And I know the whole program's not like that. Their ideology is we're like that to you for the first six months. First 6 months is you're a newbie, and they had these things called games, or you had to sit in the middle and everybody got a chance. There was men and women there to say whatever they thought of you, whatever they thought of you, whatever names, whatever they hated that you were doing at this facility. No rules were off, no words were off. And so I was getting, your fucking parents sent you out and they don't fucking love you, from like some local no and shit. So I left. I left that shit because I'm really like psychotic and dramatic when shit is like, when shit gets to me. Fuck this shit. So I fucking left. And I used for a few days with like, I ended up downtown in a high rise. I don't remember any of it. It was 4 days. And then I went back to Habilitat. I was like, take me back. I was there for 10 more days. And the entire 10 days, I was sitting in a corner. What they do is they put you in the corner. They wake you up at 6 a.m. and you have to go sit in the corner and you stay there until midnight. So you sit there for 18 hours. They bring you your food and they will take you on maybe one or two smoke breaks. And so that shit was just, I can understand maybe how it could work for some people. That program, how it plays a role in Hawaii's judicial system, is that's the last stop on the block.
Okay.
There's a lot of other programs that they will send you to if you have a prison sentence hanging over your head. And, you know, give you chance after chance after chance. This rehab is like, you're going to Habilitat or Sand Island. There's two rehabs in Hawaii that are long as fuck. You live there the whole time. Like, my parents genuinely thought that me going to Hawaii and it being beautiful and everything, that the 3 years there would help me, but it didn't. It traumatized me more.
So, okay.
Pretty much.
So I want to back up a little bit. So you're already on meth in high school. Rancho Penasquitos is a really nice area, right? Isn't it nice?
Yeah.
Okay. How did you end up, your parents are still married.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was your childhood like? And how did you start smoking meth and at what age?
You know, it's really funny because I had the most wonderful childhood. My dad coached all of my teams. Me and my sister were athletes. We played soccer and basketball and volleyball. And that continued into high school. I was a cheerleader and a volleyball player. My first issues began probably around 8 or 9 years old. with food. I would start sneaking food and eat emotionally. And my dad would be like, you already ate dinner. Like, why are you down here eating again? Midnight eating. And so I wasn't necessarily fat, but I wasn't 100 pounds like every other 10-year-old. And so, you know, playing volleyball, seeing the girls in the booty shorts. And I was like a size 10 in high school, whereas all my friends were like a size 2 or 4. And so I wasn't necessarily fat, but that instilled severe body dysmorphia. I started vomiting. I started trying to starve myself, but found that I couldn't because I fucking love food too much. And so a friend at school, God bless him, he has committed suicide at this point, but he's a sweet man, sweet boy. I only knew him as a boy, Dennis. He had ADD. And he knew that me and my best friend, Mina, she was this little Persian girl, Mina and Tina. It was funny. I don't talk to her anymore, unfortunately. But he was like, oh, well, my parents make me take this medicine every day and I fucking hate it. It makes me not hungry and I can't sleep. And I was like, oh, give it to me. No idea. 100% crossed my heart to die. I had no idea that it was Adderall. Absolutely. So I started taking it. I'm like, oh my God, this is magical. You know, like I'm doing chores and I'm not eating. I'm losing weight. I'm doing my homework, not once, but fucking 3 times in different color pink. You know what I mean? And so I thought it was like some magical pill and I didn't understand. I thought everything that came in a prescription looking bottle, because I was only like 14 at this time. I thought everything that came in a prescription looking bottle gave you that effect. And so I would start raiding my parents' pills at home. And really it's probably just like blood pressure medication and shit. I didn't know that Adderall was an amphetamine. So I had been doing that for a few months and I was able to hide it pretty well. I definitely was smoking weed with it, drinking with it. At this point, I can't be sober. So I'm trying to stay high all the time, leaving school to smoke weed and, you know, hiding the drug use or whatever. But how I started, I was at a party in Rancho Penasquitos. You know, me and my friends were partiers. We would drink every weekend, you know, and it was pretty normal to try ecstasy or shrooms. Cocaine was kind of pushing it. There was a lot of people in my school that did not do drugs. So the ones that did like stuck out and everybody knew that I had a problem with drugs. So I was at a party and there was an older man. He was probably in his early 20s, Ryan Farthing. I'll never forget him. No, you never forget the first person that gives you drugs. You could take his name out if you want or don't. I really don't care. But this, he was at a party with a bunch of teenagers. I mean, we were probably I was only 15. I know I was 15 because I was in rehab when I was 16. And he's like, hey, do you want to go outside and smoke? And you want to go to my car and smoke? And I'm drunk and smoking weed. I'm like, yeah, let's go. Woo. So we go and sit in his car and he pulls out a meth pipe. And he's like, you want some of this? He held it. He lit it for me. You know, when the guys used to hold it for you and twist it for you. I said, what is it? And he's like, it's like coke and ecstasy, but better. And so that was the first night I did meth. And I remember being up all night and doing yoga in my room. I was like stretched. I was like, hum.
Oh my God.
I was very fast before that became a problem. 6 months of that. I was also working. Claim Jumper. I don't know if you know Claim Jumper.
I remember. Steakhouse. Yeah, there was one in Carlsbad off the 78. I don't think I ever went there, but I know of it. Yeah, it's a steakhouse.
That's where I was working in high school part time. So I would go to work fucking high as balls, running all over the earth. I'm sure everybody could tell, but it was after about 6 months of using, I had lost weight and I had really started to experience what come downs felt like, what the desperation felt like, what. You know, if I couldn't get meth, if I couldn't get any type of drugs, I would walk to the store and steal a bottle of alcohol. I don't even like alcohol, but it's just, I needed something to change my mindset. And so my parents put me into a rehab for 30 days in Orange County.
Okay.
And I came back and they're like, we're going to be testing you every week. And within a week, probably I was smoking weed and drinking again. And then I started sneaking the meth. And somehow I graduated high school.
How did you graduate high school doing all this?
Okay, well, you know what was really sad is I played varsity volleyball my freshman and sophomore year. And junior year, I went to tryouts with my Letterman jacket on. When you've been on varsity 2 years already, you are like, I have a spot. It's like you almost don't even need to try at tryouts. Of course I did. I was a good player. And when he read off the names, he didn't read my name. And he replaced me with a freshman. And so I was kicked off the team. And that was like probably one of my first real consequences of my addiction because I loved sports to death. I was good at them. I also played softball. They knew what was going on, but they didn't kick me off the team. And so when I went to rehab, I was in my junior year. My senior year, my parents put me into something called Abraxas. It's like the program at Poway for troubled kids or pregnant moms. It's like they give you a packet once a week and you just have to turn it in. And so that was so fucking easy. And so, you know, my principal, the school worked with me and everything. And so I didn't go to school my senior year. I did like homeschool. And then I walked with my class. I had like a 3.2, you know, so I am a very smart girl. I got into Cal State Long Beach.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, you know, my mom helped me apply to colleges. She pretty much did it all for me. It's like when I was just smoking weed and drinking, it seems like I could handle myself okay. But then I would always want to, as soon as I would get drunk, I'd want to go find meth. So anyways, I go to college. I live in the dorms for the first 6 months. I have a disabled roommate. God bless her heart. She had no hand. She was missing her hand. So when I met her, I was like, okay. She was a total fucking square. I don't think she had ever taken a hit of anything in her life. And God forbid she had me as a roommate. I would come in late. I didn't bring people there, but I would use drugs. And at this point in time, I gained 80 pounds. When I went my freshman year in college, they say the freshman 15. My parents had me on like the dorm food plan. And I was really trying to not do meth. So I was just smoking a lot of fucking weed and drinking. And I had the munchies all the time. I would eat, barf, and go right back. Eat. I would sometimes have like a six meal session. And so the bulimia was really, really bad. And everybody in the dorm knew. They could hear me in the bathroom. And so I was supposed to be in the dorms for the whole first year, but my dad was like, I want you to go online and find a roommate and we're going to put you in an apartment. My parents really, really, really tried hard. And so I'm only 18 at this point. And I lived with this little emo girl. She was like a little goth emo girl. She was super cool and quiet. She knew what I was up to, but she didn't say anything. And so that's where I lived for the second half of my freshman year. Oh my God, this is so funny. I forgot about this. So when I go back for my sophomore year, the first group of girls that I move in with are sorority girls or something that don't live in the sorority. I steal their alcohol the first night. And so they kick me out. They kicked me out after the first night. I went and I tried to add, like, I definitely did that. And so that was when my parents put me into this cute little studio, $900 a month by myself. They were like, this is the last straw. Like, please. Obviously, that was not a good idea. It just worsened the drug use. And that is where I met a guy named Chris. I guess that you could say I was attracted to him. Looking back, it was prison tattoos that he had. But he was a doctor hopper. This is when they were giving oxys out like fucking crazy to everybody.
Okay.
And so I had a car. And so when I would go, he would drop me off at school and then use my car to go to the doctors. And then he was also living with me. That's when I started with the yellow Norcos and the Oxy 80s. We would smoke the 80s off the foil. But I always noticed that he was always fucking slumped. Like I could still walk around, but he'd go in the bathroom for a long time and then he'd come out and be knotted out hard. And finally I was like, what are you on? Because I want some of that. I'm not getting high like you, you know? And it turns out he was shooting black tar heroin in my bathroom. And I fought with him tooth and nail. I said, I want some. And he's like, no, I'm not going to give it to you. I said, if you don't give me my first shot of heroin, you cannot stay here anymore. I'll kick your fucking ass out. That's so bad of an addict I was. I made him shoot me up with heroin.
Oh, and my gosh.
Then it began. I dropped out of college shortly after that. And then I went to 4 rehabs, Serenity House twice, and Whiteside Manor in Riverside twice. Failed all of them. And so that was when I got sent to Hawaii.
Okay. Wow. Well, I'm really glad. I'm really glad that we backed up the story and started there because that was a lot of really helpful information, actually. Like the food stuff that started so young, because I want to go back to that now that you're in recovery and talk about, you know, how you're able to manage all of those feelings now, because those feelings don't go away. We just come up with different ways to manage them. So your first shot of heroin, and then you get strung out within a month or so to the point where you're shooting every day. Otherwise you get sick.
Yeah. And so on spring break of the second of my junior year, at this point I'm failing. I mean, it's not like I'm even going to school really. My parents, I called them. I wasn't shooting meth yet. Shooting meth adds a whole fucking new game to it, don't it? Like anyways, but my parents were like, okay, well, we're going to come up and pack your stuff up and you're going to come home for spring break and then you're going to go back. Or not, they didn't say pack my stuff up. They just said come home. And so into maybe day 3 of being there, I remember vividly waking up and my legs were moving and I had such horrible anxiety and I was pouring sweat and Chelsea Handler – that show that she used to have on E! Was playing on the TV. And he had given me some pills to take home. He's like, you might want to take these. And so whatever, I think he gave me some Xanax, but he didn't give me like any opiates. Oh. And so that was when I experienced withdrawal. And that was when I, you know, would leave on foot because my parents supported me until I was like, you know, in my 20s. They still help me with a few things financially, but for the most part, I pay my rent. I, you know, pay for everything. They just help me with my phone. And that's only because I'm still on the plan and it would be not good to get off it.
So you got dope sick for the first time at your parents' house on spring break. Did you know you were going to get dope sick?
No, I didn't. I knew that I was going to come down. Like I pictured it as just like maybe another come down from meth or something. I had no idea that that was what it felt like. And oh my God, I just remember being so ungodly uncomfortable. And I literally would have had sex with a 750-pound hairy, stinky man if it meant getting well. I mean, the things that I was okay to do.
For sure. And of course. I've never heard that particular analogy, but that's a great one. That's like totally. So what did you do that time? Did you tell your parents or did you try to get well? Did you know opiates was what you needed to feel better? Or did you think that you had like the flu?
Yeah, I think I knew that I needed more opiates. But I think what I did is I went into the kitchen and drank their alcohol. And then I think my parents, like I did smoke weed and they didn't necessarily really care. I probably went and tried to take hits of something. And I probably went and asked my parents if they had something to give me. Cause I know my dad does have like a benzo prescription that of course he never takes. My parents are not addicts at all. And they wouldn't do it. And that was when like the psychotic episodes would start, when I would be so sick and I would feel so lost and scared and terrified. And I used to be very outwardly, I would scream, I fucking hate you, slamming doors. And I wasn't aggressive like physically, but I'm gonna fucking kill myself. I'm gonna hurt myself. I do see now that I'm clean, like I needed a lot of attention when I was younger and I got it from boys. I got it from, you know, I got it from doing a lot. I mean, I was definitely known at high school. Everybody knew me as like the party girl and being loud and shit. But yeah, it's crazy.
Okay. So did you tell them that you were on heroin at that point or how did they find out?
Yeah, I think I told them I was on heroin. And at this point, you know, with the poly substance uses, when you're doing so many different substances like alcohol and weed and pills and meth, and I mean, the thing is I didn't know where to get it. I didn't know where to get Plexxar. I only really knew tweakers. I think I would probably call my tweaker friends. I remember them always trying to help me find it and not being able to. And so I would like search medicine cabinets. And if I found some Vicodin, I would try and like melt it down in the spoon and extract. I was like looking up online, science experiment, how to extract the opiates from a Vicodin so I could shoot it. Like what? I mean, you can't even do that.
I Googled that once too. You can shoot Oxy. You can shoot Oxy, but you have to do a whole process. And I looked that up once too, because I was hanging out with someone that he knew how. He was a heroin addict, but if we didn't have any, he like knew how. And it's blue. You shoot blue liquid from the Oxys. Then went late, like I was by myself at my mom's once, and that was all I had. And it was stupid because if I had just eaten it, I would have been okay, but I was trying to figure out how to shoot it because you know how it goes. Once you're on the needle, that's the only thing you want to do. And so I was doing the same thing. I was trying to Google it. Also, like, did you ever run into, I feel like there was always a tweaker that would randomly like have heroin on them that they didn't want to use. And you know what I mean? There was always a tweaker around that would have, yeah, and be like, oh, do you want this? And I'm like, yeah, I want that. Or like my friend Zarina, and I have another friend, Chris. Chris would actually keep, I actually want to interview him on the show. He's clean now too, like 10 years. He was a meth dealer. He was the meth connect. And he would always keep like a gram of heroin on him for me and this other girl, Amber. If we ever got really sick, we could go to his house. Like if there was a drought in San Diego, which would happen sometimes, Chris would have a little bit for me.
I was in Hawaii. When we would have droughts, the entire drug community would go into a panic.
That's insane. Because, yes,
we felt droughts. And the drugs are twice the price there. A gram of heroin here was like 60. There, you could get 120, 150 for a gram. Everything there is twice the price. A 20 bag of meth there is only like 2 points.
Wow.
It's like a couple grams here, I think. So
no, a 20 here would be 0.2. Yeah, a 0.2 of, or like a 20, like a dub of heroin is 0.2. And then I guess I don't know what the measurement of meth would be, but I know a dub of heroin was 0.2 on the scale. But I was also probably getting ripped off a lot. I don't know, because a gram for me was 80. And so I think I was way out of my fucking element in the beginning.
Ripped off a lot. You know, being a white girl that's, I guess, I don't know, just a white girl that looks different. In Hawaii, I stood out. I'd love to tell you a little bit more about when I left Habilitat. Yes. Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I want to talk more about Habilitat too. So how old are you when your parents send you to Hawaii?
21.
Okay. So they send you to Hawaii. And if no one knows what behavior modification is, I do, but I never went to one. Like, what exactly is it? I know you said a little bit about, like, you know, they yell at you and there's these very negative tactics that they use. What is the goal there?
So they're not 12-step based. They follow kind of almost like a military type of thing. And so there's phases of treatment. You're in the first 6 months is called the treatment phase. The next phase is like the reentry phase. And then the next phase after that is the post reentry phase. And so the first 6 months, they are tough on you. When you get there, they make you stand in the office with both of the bosses and they say, scream for help. Okay, help. No. Scream for help. Scream for help like you mean it. Help! Help! No, I want to hear it. I want to hear it in your voice. It's like so weird. And so whenever new people would come in, we would hear them, you know. You always knew there was a new person because you could hear them yelling, help, help. They would make you get up and do it in front of the whole house too. So it's a big program too. It's 120 residents and it's men and women. A lot of these people are on their last resort to jail. So we are talking hardened criminals that are stubborn and mean and violent.
Is it legal now? Do they still have those?
Legal to do what? To yell at you? I mean, yeah, it's legal.
I mean, are there still behavior modification programs?
I mean, yeah, Habilitat is definitely still in business. It is.
Why do they have you scream for help? To show you no one's going to help you?
They want to humiliate you, one, and two, I don't really know how to explain it. Like, they have these things called dishpans. And also let me tell you, when you get there, you cannot talk to the men. You cannot look at the men. You have a buddy system. You go to the bathroom with a buddy. Your bed needs to be made with the corners tucked. When you get there, two women take you into a shower, make you shower. They watch you. I mean, we signed waivers to all of this, though. So it's a hard fucking core program. And, you know, beautiful as it was. And, you know, they did do nice things, too. Like, I was there for Christmas and Halloween and stuff. And they do, like, events. And they had, like, a talent show and stuff. But for the most part, I just didn't agree with their treatment approach. You know, I'm already, like, traumatized and hurt. And you're traumatizing and hurting me more.
Yeah.
So, you know, okay. It did, like, make me stronger. And one thing I need to throw in, too, is, like, being white in Hawaii is not always easy. You know, some parts of the island, there's mixed. You see all different kinds of races, but there are parts of the island where it is just locals. And so after I finally left for the second time, oh, wait, I didn't tell you what they did when I came back. So I left and partied for 4 days and then came back all fucking picking my face and tweaking. Can you take me back? And they made me sit in the corner for 10 days. And on the 10th day, I said, I can't fucking take this anymore. I got up and walked out. I didn't even take my clothes. I literally walked off with the clothes on my back. And so somehow I got bus money to downtown because I was on the Kailua side of Oahu. And so I got a bus to downtown and I was like, where's the homeless shelter? I didn't go to the downtown one. They ended up taking me to Pearl City homeless shelter. And so I was there for about 4 nights, but you had to leave during the day. And so I would wake up at 6 on a hard concrete floor. They didn't like give you really much except blankets and a very thin pad, but I was grateful for it. And they also provided a meal. And I think I was probably there for maybe 3 or 4 days. And I was saying, you know, where could I go from here? And someone recommended a program on the west side of the island in Waianae. That was, you know, only 90 days. It's not like a crazy thing. And so it's 90 days and then you go into sober living and do outpatient and it's 12-step based. It's just like a program that I know and I've been to. And it's culturally based. So we learn hula. We go pull tarot. We get to learn chants. Every morning we have to introduce ourselves in Hawaiian. Aloha, ka hiaka, ka Christina. I don't remember now, but I did then. And so I did really good in the hula. I actually did well there. I stayed and I was clean for 93 days. 3 days after I moved into sober living, I ran into another client that had been discharged at a Burger King. And I saw him and I was like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, fuck, I'm high. And the addict impulse... oh, fuck, you might have something. Hey, you got something? And sure enough, I went and snorted a fat line of meth in the bathroom. Snorting meth traumatized the fuck out of my nose. But anyways, so that was when the relapse started. And that was where the homelessness started. And then I met a really nice man named Libby. He was in the military and he let me live with him, and he actually didn't perv on me. Like, he genuinely just tried to help me. And I got a job at Chili's, and I'm like trying to be functioning and using at this point. And I'm getting checks. I'm getting a $350-ish check every 2 weeks. And so I apply for a loan for a car. I get a cheap little car for $2,000. And that became my home for the next, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. I think I had that car for about 5 years. You know, and I tried to continue living at Libby's, but he got deployed to Germany. And so I had to move out. And so at that point I was in my car. You know, it's really hard to find heroin on that side of the island. I'll just tell you, there on the west side of Oahu, it's the most violent part of the island. It's the most, you know, that's where most of the gangs are and the drugs, Waianae, Makaha. It's just, you know, and so I got ate alive. My first couple years living in my car, I cannot tell you how many times I got jacked, set up, beat up. Two girls jumped me outside of a grocery store because they said I stole some kids' slippers off their back porch. They said I stole an 8-year-old's pair of sandals off a porch. Okay, I did steal sandals, but I didn't take the 8-year-olds. So, and there was a few different Hawaiian families that did try and help me. And like, I did meet a guy that I was with for a little bit, but everybody, so meth is so fucking common there. It's like in high school here, we'll pass bowls of weed around. High school there, they pass the bubble around like it's normal. And one thing I have to say too is I experienced so much violence from men. I got beat up by men like more times than I can even count. A lot of them I don't even remember. And I'm kind of glad, like, ignorance is bliss, you know, but I do remember when this guy redid this tattoo for me. He told me that he could fix it and that he was in recovery and all this. And so he took me to a motel and he did it. And I kept telling him, like, I don't have any money. Like, are you sure you just want to practice on me and stuff? And so turns out after we're done, he's like, so are you going to suck my dick? And I was like, no, I had never done anything like that before, like in exchange for stuff. And I said, no. And I got really scared. And so he dragged me back to the car and drove me all the way back out to the west side to like some deserted ass area where there's no one. And he started punching me and fucking opened the door and threw me out and then drove off and left me.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that kind of shit happened to me like multiple times. And so that was when I really started like finding my fucking gangster in me. You know what I mean? Like, you are not going to fucking do this shit to me no more. And I started defending myself and I started being more aware that, you know, they're not always on your good side. My car got stolen 3 times. And the last time it got stolen, dude, check this. I called my friend Akamai and I was like, dude, someone stole my car. I don't know. Some tweakers. He's like, hold on. Let me make a call. He calls some. He's got family over there. They found out where my car was. And me and Akamai drove up there. I got out the car and I was like, what's up? You know what I mean? And it was just two guys and a girl. I was like, where are my keys? Where are my fucking keys? You know? And I got my keys. And sure enough, everything that was in my car had either been taken out or searched through. I just took the car and left. You know, sometimes you just got to take the loss. But yeah, dude, I've never told anybody any of this, Janine, not even my boyfriend. All the stuff that I'm telling you right now, I don't talk about because I feel like people don't care or they think, you know, are judging me or something. So this truly and honestly is the first time I've ever shared anything about this. So, you know, my boyfriend knows that I was homeless in Hawaii and that people beat me up and stuff, but he doesn't know like the severity of it. And I feel like when I talk about it with him, it almost hurts him so much and I can see it in his face. So I just don't say anything. So it feels really good to be able to talk about this with you.
Well, I am honored that you're sharing it here, and it demands respect when somebody is willing to share. There's nothing else that you can give them other than respect. And it demands respect that you share. And the people that listen care. My audience cares. The NodPod community is amazing. They care. And you're telling people's story right now. That's why we do this. And people do care. And it's brave for you to share and to share the specifics. And that's why I like to do the show, because, you know, I'm a 12-step person, as are you. And I love 12 step. That's my preferred form of recovery. I know there's a bunch of different ways to do it, but I love 12 step. One of the things they do is we don't share the stories because it's covered under this blanket of, we all know what it's like out there. Here's the solution. And I get it. I understand that mentality. But at the same time, I always felt like, well, it probably wasn't as bad as me then. And because you have a car and you have 10 years clean and you're married to this good looking dude and you have a house, you didn't get beat up in Hawaii. You can't have, you wouldn't have survived. And so we have a space to share actual stories and say, look at you now. And this happened to me. Someone out there needs to hear that it was this, that it was the depraved stuff and the violence, and you did get better. That's why we share the details, you know?
I love that word. It really is just diabolical depravity. I mean, people did awful fucking things to me. Awful things. I remember one time I got robbed. One of the times they took my car, they took everything, my phone, my purse, everything that was in it, and left me on the side of the road with nothing. And I had to call the police. The police were the ones that helped me get it back the first two times. You know, God bless their heart that they went out and looked for my car. This part of the island's pretty small. So that was when I just remember feeling terrified, alone, and that I couldn't handle being sober. Everything hurt and was painful, not physically, but mentally. They just didn't have heroin on that side of the island. They just are not into it. They're into meth. So I was shooting meth. I got down to like 140 pounds. I was back down to a size five. A size five! That's really small for me. And it was shortly after that that I met the man who trafficked me. And so, you know, that plays a large part into this. If you want to ask any other questions before I talk about that, but that's how that started.
Okay. So what did your parents think during this time? Did you have any communication with them?
That's a really great question because yes, I did. I would often call them in tears. You know, when traumatic things happen, you immediately call your parents, you know, I can't understand you. And so, you know, I know that they felt really bad and I know that they wanted to bring me home. And I know that they stood laid up all night, every night worrying about me because every week someone stole my phone. Someone stole my ID. Someone ripped me off. Dad, I'm sick. Please, can you send me 50? My dad would secretly send me money, only $50 at a time, maybe once a week. So that was one shot for me. You know, $50 is one shot of the day. So it's not like he just, I don't know. My dad had like a soft spot for me and he's like, don't tell your mom. And so, you know, my mom knows now, but my mom is the one that was like, we need to give her tough love. We need to stop enabling her. Like, this is what it's going to take for her to learn. But, you know, I just wasn't expecting to be put into so many dangerous situations. You know, I can't tell you how many times men have put their hands on me because I didn't want to do anything with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, yeah, we'll hang out. I pick them up. And then they start leaning into, I can't tell you how many guys have said, so are you going to suck my dick? Like, is that how you approach a girl? Like, if you're trying to get your dick sucked, like, why don't you play with my hair and kiss me or something? You know, so you can suck my dick. Like, it's just so fucking gross, you know?
No, and, that's insane. That's not a good way to get somebody to do that at all.
No, it's not. And it was just like, and so I remember two of them at separate occasions, you know, getting violent with me because I didn't want to. Yeah. All right. Then you fucking bitch. Hey, why are you getting all mad? You know what? No, fuck this. I came out here to hang out. We're just going to fucking leave me hanging. Fuck this. And then it just like, they just start punching me in the car. And it's just like, I have a scar on my lip from one of them. One of them busted my lip. There was blood like pouring down. I mean, because I don't want to have sex with you and I don't want to give you an orgasm. Like, are you fucking kidding me? Men, I am severely traumatized by men. Let's just say that much. My boyfriend is the sweetest, most gentle, kindest man, and God put him in my life for this reason, because I needed a gentle and kind man.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you meet the man who traffics you.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like?
I'm living in my car in downtown Honolulu. At this point, I use my womanly skills to get myself high, like, but I don't do anything with them. I just flirt. Hey, I'm sick, or can you help me? And then I can hustle men for money, but I wasn't having sex with them and I wasn't doing shit. When I met him, I was parked in the Don Quixote parking lot under the shaded area. I would often park there because it would get hot. and I had all four of my car doors open. I was had piles of shit outside the car. I was trying to clean my car. I had a keep pile, maybe keep pile. I had a trash pile. He walks up with a guy that I knew that had let me stay at his house a couple times. Oh, bless his heart. He had like this long beard and really like bad breath, but he would always help me and let me stay. And I slept next to him and he respected me, but I think he probably laid there like with a boner, like wishing he could do something, you know. But anyways, so he walked up with Austin. I don't even care. I'm just going to say his fucking name. And Austin was attractive. I'm not going to lie. He is. And he was, you know, got tats and shit. And he's like, oh, who is this? And I'm all like, oh, hi, you know, fucking jaw grinding and shit. And so it was very obvious that I was high. I was a picker, so I had sores on my face. And so he immediately went into wooing me, if you will. And he didn't have a place to stay either because he had just gotten out of prison 2 days before that. 2 days before we met, he had gotten out of prison. And so me to him was perfect. And he used me to survive. I mean, he didn't love me, you know, like I loved him. I got this loyalty tattoo for him. It was super ugly. I got it redone. But I was like very manipulated and twisted into, if you really love me, you will do this to support us. And I did love him and I wanted him to love me. And he would go out and stay out all night with girls and come back in the morning. We were just living in like hostels in Waikiki, or like, you know, sometimes we'd get paid by the night or weekly. And yeah, I remember one time he was wanted to leave to go out, and I had just gotten back from doing dates and had given him the money. I had picked up my dope and I just wanted to get well and hang out with him. He was going to leave and go out with girls. And I said, please don't leave me. Like, you know, the first few nights of doing that, going from room to room and shit, like, it's traumatizing. And I remember I wanted him to stay with me just for comfort. And he's like, no, I'm going out. And I was like, if you leave right now, I'm going to kill myself. I used to be psychotic like that. And I took, this is funny as fuck, I took a can of roach spray, bug spray, and I fucking inhaled that shit.
What happened when you did that?
I said, I'm going to kill myself.
Oh my gosh, Christina.
Oh my God, that is so funny. It just tasted terrible and I fucking went and spit it out. And of course he still left. And so at this point, I'm just doing drug after drug. And I remember him coming home at like 4 a.m. that night. I was laying in the bed awake and he laid down next to me. And I was like, I love you, Austin. And he, I was like, do you love me too? And he was like, honestly, I really love you like a sister and a friend, but I don't. And I was like, well, can you just tell me that you do? I'll never forget that I asked him. I said, can you please just pretend like you do? Because I feel like I felt like I couldn't live without him. The pimp instills like such a fucking manipulated tactic into your brain. I didn't even know that I was being trafficked. I didn't even realize it until two years ago, all my 20s, I was like, oh yeah, I had a pimp. I was a bottom bitch, like talking all like that and shit. No, it wasn't like that. Looking back now, I was severely taken advantage of. Him and his friend, Prince. I just remember that. I didn't do well on the strip, like walking around in a dress and heels. I just didn't. Okay, this is what I look like. Hi, you want to hang out? No? Okay. Hi, you want to hang out? No. Okay. You know, I don't know. It's weird. It was weird. Like I can hustle men, but not out there in heels and a dress. Like, and so, and I would often leave with men like, oh, well, why don't we go over to the beach and smoke? I'd be like, and I'd follow him, and Austin would call me, where the fuck you at, bitch? Because he would watch me. He'd stand across the street. Oh, I went across the way to smoke some weed with this guy. Get the fuck back here now. You know, and he was like a white guy. I think he had a little Indian in him, but you know, I really went with that whole bottom bitch mentality. Like, I am such a down bitch that I'll do this for my man. And I'll even recruit for him. You know, I'll even bring more girls in. I don't know why I thought that that was what I wanted, but it was just crazy. And so we were together for probably like a year and a half. And what was weird is he was on what is here, fourth waiver over there. It's like their drug court. So it's like, I don't know. He has to call every single day. And if there's a color, he has to go and test. And so he wasn't doing hard drugs at first. He was just smoking spice. I don't know if you've ever smoked that shit, but it's fucking crazy.
I haven't, but I know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. crazy. And so we were just living in my car, sleeping on the beach. Sometimes I'd make enough to get us a hotel room, but for the most part, all I wanted to do was pick up drugs and inject them. Oh, and then I didn't, oh, that was why I was saying I didn't do well on the strip. So that was when they put me in the Asian massage parlor. And I remember working there for like maybe a couple months. They were all tiny, petite Asian women. And then me. That was when I started getting traumatized because I would say, please stop. Like, you're hurting me. Can you please slow down? You know, don't go so far in. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Please stop. You know, and they would either agree and go soft, or they would say, shut the fuck up, bitch. I paid for this shit, you know? I'm gonna fuck it how I want to, you know? And I just would go home every night and just erase the pain away with more shots of dope. Austin didn't give a shit. It was weird, though, because at one point he did, like, start having strange feelings for me. And after a date once, I remember he, like, reached down and felt my pussy. And he's like, why are you wet? Why are you wet? And I was like, I used lube. He's like, no, you liked it. You liked it. And then he would always go to jail for like a couple days and then get out. A couple days and get out. That's how it is. They put it on the program that he's on. They'll put you in for a weekend or put you in for a week. And so when he would go in, of course, I would put money on his books. One time when he went in, he brought a huge fucking condom that was full of tobacco, a tattoo gun, a lighter, a needle, dope. We fit it all. Like, it was like a big dildo and I shoved it up his ass.
Oh my gosh. A tattoo gun was in there?
It was like the motor for it. The little
pencil looking one. Okay. Whoa.
And so it was, that was fucking funny. But there's the point that I would hold the fort down. When he would go, I would make enough to hold whatever room we had down. I would put money on his books. And so one day he got out and I was supposed to have picked him up from jail. I was stuck in the room trying to find a vein. Like, it was probably around 23 that I started losing my veins. He bust it home. I guess he had been trying to call and I didn't answer. He stormed into the room and he saw me sitting on the floor with needles scattered all around me and blood all over me. And he's like, you know what? Fuck this shit. I'm fucking done with this shit. I'm putting you in fucking rehab and, you know, we're going to get better. And so that was when I got real confused. And I was like, oh my God, so maybe he does love me. And so we actually moved to the other side of the island and he got a job working as a dishwasher. I went to detox and got on Suboxone. So that was like, oh my God, I earned his love. I finally earned his love, you know? And then, yeah, it's just, I don't even remember. It's just, he kept going in to jail because he couldn't stay clean. And I kept using and we kept getting kicked out of places. And finally, he just kind of gave up on me. And he called me and said that he was going to Vegas with another girl. He's like, I got a girl. She's got a car. She has money. And that's where I'm going. I drove over to where he was and I got out the car. You can't fucking leave me. You can't fucking do this to me. You turned me into a fucking prostitute. Now you're just going to leave me. I was psychotic. I was terrified. I was so terrified. And I remember running after him and grabbing his shirt. And we were fighting. Like, I was like, please, please, bawling my eyes out. Don't leave me. Don't leave me. He grabs me and pushes me off of him as hard as he can. And I fall to the ground. And he goes, and he hawked a huge fucking loogie in my face. And he's like, leave me the fuck alone, bitch. And so that was when, I think I was 23. That was when the using where I was just, I would put like a gram of heroin in my shots. I was trying to die. I was literally, and that was also where I met Fred. I don't know if you've seen any of my posts about my best friend, the older man that passed away.
I maybe have.
God definitely put him in my life as an angel. I was living in my car on the streets and I met him and he helped me. He was actually the biggest dealer in Waikiki at the time because he had Oxy prescriptions. He would get 360 a month and he would sell those fuckers for 30 bucks each, a dollar a milligram. And so I lived in his house and he let me do as much drugs as I wanted. It was like a dream for me. Totally. And I started getting fat again. All I did was just sleep, eat. Some nights I would get twacked out and stay up all night, but that would usually just be cleaning or picking my face. I mean, I was just so depressed and I was so mad at myself. I was like, why did you do that for him?
Yeah. Okay.
I've never talked about this. So sorry, I'm getting like a little emotional.
No, that's okay. I cannot tell you how honored I am that you're sharing this right now. I'm going to be totally honest with you right now. I think this might be my favorite episode that I have ever done. Ever, because of your like authenticity and vulnerability and sharing. Like, I'm so grateful that you're on the show and that you're here sharing, and you're an amazing storyteller, and it paints such like a clear, vivid picture. You're such a good storyteller, and like the way that you're sharing your experience is really amazing. Like, you also have a gift, and I know that you've gotten into this space of sharing your gift on TikTok and Instagram, and like, you know, sharing your experience and trying to help other women. And I just want to tell you right now that you're so good at this, and you definitely, I think, have a space and a calling here to keep doing that and to keep doing what you're doing. And I'm really proud of you, and I'm very honored that you're sharing this right now. So thank you. First of all, thank you.
That means the world to me, Janine, because you were probably the first person that I was like, I want to do like a recovery thing on social media. And I would see your posts about like sober livings, and then the one where you come back from pass and your eyes are all buzzed. I had a good time going to sleep. You know, I remember those vividly.
And that's the first one I made, I think. My friend Alexa helped me make it, and it's "Don't be suspicious, don't be suspicious." And my eyes are like bugging out.
You know, I've definitely seen like a lot more followers that you have, and who I look up to you a lot. So again, thank you for having me on the show. I mean, the rest of my story is pretty, you know, that's pretty much it. I pretty much just used for the next 7 years. I gambled, and I tried to sell drugs, and I was just, and then I just continued to do individual sex work. And so I own that, you know, I own that I did do it on my own, but I don't feel like I would have had I not been introduced to Austin. So,
So is it okay if I ask you a few questions about meeting Austin in that time? Okay. Cause I want to go back and unpack a little bit of that. So, cause I want people to understand how this happens, right? Because you're obviously intelligent. You obviously have street smarts by now when you meet him. You're from this great family. How does this happen? So you're tweaking out with your stuff around the car, and you're like, hi, which for those of you that are listening and not watching, she's like running her jaw, like, hi, you know, like how we all were. You meet him. How does he get you to start going? You said you end up in a motel going room to room to room. How does that first conversation happen? Is he like, hey, we need money. I need you to start sleeping with people. I need you to do this for me. How does that conversation happen?
Okay. So he didn't really bring anything up to me in the beginning. He talked about himself like he was, oh, I was in prison for 2 years because I robbed a drug dealer and shit. Like, and his nickname was Ruckus. So he'd be like, oh, they call me Ruckus because I cause a ruckus. I don't know. Something about him just drew me to him. And he knew that right off the bat. Like, it was very obvious that I had feelings for him right off the bat. And so the very first time we hung out, we went to a park and had sex under a blanket. That's another thing I used to do often, is I would have sex with men right away. Not because I wanted to, but because I thought that that's what they wanted. And if I did it, they would like me more. But truly, that's not the way to do it, ladies. And so I remember feeling really gross. And he made me feel cheap about it after, too. He just got, all right, let's go. And we lived outside a lot. We slept outside in parks. We slept on the beach. I mean, you know, he was homeless, too. And so he introduced me to this guy named Prince. That was when the conversation of, because Prince had a girl that would work for him. And so he's like, well, why don't you do what we do, you know? And I was like, no, hell no. And Austin got upset about that. And so I'm fucking doing that. And so I knew some people up in Pearl City. He was actually a retired cop, dude. Or not a retired cop. He was a cop, and he got fired off the force. This fucking tweaker white guy. But anyways, I went and stayed with him. And I remember just wondering, like, what is Austin doing? Who is he hanging out with? Like, did I fuck everything up? Because no matter what a piece of shit he was a piece of fucking shit. But I thought that he was Brad fucking Pitt. He could not do wrong in my eyes. But I would text him, you know, like, what are you doing? And, well, you know, if you want to come back, yeah, I need you to hear us out and, like, try this. And I was like, and I remember just being like, okay, well, I'm only going to do it if I can get, you know, as much drugs as I want. And he also, like, painted this picture, like, I'll be able to get you off the streets. I'll be able to help you. And you know what? To give him a tiny bit of credit, I guess he did. Because, you know, there were times he used the money that he gave him to get us rooms and stuff. So he did take me off the street in a way. But I remember the very first night, you know, I started writing a recovery memoir, and I'm 5 chapters in. It was at this point that I'm about to tell you that I stopped writing. I remember the night vividly. So they took me to where Prince and his girl were staying. It was actually in like a nice ass part of Hawaii, like mansions. And they had a tiny little studio basement underneath the mansion. So it still was like super tweaky once you got in there. This girl was like probably in her mid 40s. I mean, she was older. She had like short red hair, a lot of makeup, and like put her in a dress and put her in a heel and put her in heels. I mean, I had worn dresses before, but not little stripper dresses that hardly show your vagina, you know, and I've never walked in stripper fucking heels. And so that's what they put me in. And so I got high as fuck. That was another thing too, is like I would get really fucking high on meth and heroin, shoot them both together. And then I would want to go out. I'd be like, yeah, I want to go make more money, You know, because at a certain point I did, it became a job to me. And so I knew how to, hi, how you doing? Like I knew how to get it over with very quickly without not losing a potential customer. I'm a good employee. And so I wanted my customers to return. So I would treat them good, but I also knew what to do and what to say to get it over with as fast as possible. If you're sitting there like, I don't want to, they don't like that. You have to just pretend for 5 seconds. Ooh, yeah, you know? And so anyways, I would get it over with as fast as possible. And I remember the first night, the first time I made a lot of money, I think I made
$1,200. Oh, wow.
I brought it home and I wouldn't go from motel room to room. What I'm talking about more is like different hotels in Waikiki, because a lot of customers at this point, also let me remind you, they put me on Backpage. Or I did not remind you. I didn't say anything to you yet.
But I've seen your picture. I've seen your picture on TikTok that they put on Backpage.
Yeah. And so I was getting a lot of people that were on vacation, a lot of businessmen, like a lot of military guys. So yeah, I went home that night and I gave him the money and he had tears in his eyes and he literally started crying. Not like crying. He just was like, why do you do this for me, Tina? Everyone used to call me Tina. I said, because I love you, Austin. Don't you know that by now? And he hugged me so tight and he's like, thank you so much. Like, so he could genuinely see that I would have done anything for him. And you know what's sad is like the whole time there was a little voice in the back of my head looking in on everything that I knew that it was wrong. And I knew that I deserved better. And I knew that he didn't really love me, but I was just so deep in it. And so, yeah, that's how it started the first night. That was when they put me out on the strip the first night and I hated it. I did terrible. And so that was when they put me in the massage parlor. But then Austin kept going out and like hooking up with girls. And so I tried to, you know, end it and I fucking packed all my shit. And another white girl that had started working at the Asian massage parlor, dude, I don't know what her pimp and her were doing, but they were in the fucking penthouse of a huge ass building in Hawaii. And so when I told her what was happening, I was like, you know, Austin, they're like, he's a piece of fucking shit and he doesn't have anything to offer you. So you're going to work for us now. And so I went with that girl under him. They gave me my own apartment. They literally took me to this apartment. They're like, the other girl used to stay here, but she left. So it was already like lived in and there was women's clothes there and stuff. They had that apartment and another apartment for their girls to stay in. And they were living up in the penthouse and they had kids and shit.
Wow.
So, you know, you do this in a way where you can make money from it if the girl's okay with it. But I hated it. I just hated it. If I don't want to have sex with someone, it's just the most awful feeling. And I would always have sex like this. Like I would have my hands clenched and I still do it. I still do it to this day. Bradley always says that my hands are like this because it's like a distinctive, you know, but anyway, so yeah, that was how that started. And I just hated it so much, but I was just, I didn't want Austin to leave. I really didn't want him to leave. And so for it to have ended like that and with him spitting the loogie in my face and leaving me crying in the fetal position, please don't leave me. I mean, looking back now, I see like how pathetic I was and how. Right.
No, that's not pathetic. Listen, that's not pathetic. That's not pathetic. You were traumatized and he was taking care of you and he was a source of support and you didn't know and you were strung out. That's not pathetic. It's pathetic that he did that. It's pathetic that he did that, not you. You know,
it really set the bar for, you know, the next boyfriend I had after him was only with me because I sold heroin. And he told people that I knew that I gained a bunch of weight too. After Austin left, I got all the way up to 250 pounds. So I still, I guess, had a pretty face, but I was pretty chunky. And Devin, the guy, you know, he was one of my customers and he started hanging out with me a lot, obviously, because I'm the connect. And I was the type of connect that would like give you a point to get well. When I started staying with Fred at his studio, we would have people staying there too. And, you know, I would give them dope in exchange for like doing something or whatever. I always tried to like help out.
So he leaves And then what does life start to look like for you after he leaves? Like, what is the point between Austin leaving and you leaving Hawaii? How many years and what did those look like?
It was another 7 years.
Holy shit. And,
me and Austin were together from age 22 to 23. Okay. I didn't move back from Hawaii until I was 30. So you can imagine the destruction that I did. I continued prostituting or selling to support myself. And I also had Fred. You know, Fred had limits, and I try not to take too much advantage of someone who's willing to give. And I took care of him too. Bless his heart. But yeah, that was when I started losing all my veins. That's when I started getting abscesses. That's when I started to become covered in abscesses. I would have one on my neck, one on my arm, one on my leg. And I would go and do dates with guys and they'd be like, oh, what happened? I'd be like, it's a new tattoo. It's a new tattoo. Hell no, it ain't a new tattoo. That shit is nasty as fuck under there. Dude, I had fucking abscesses that would squirt fucking far. I mean, I know it's so disgusting, but I know that abscesses and skin infections is such a part of IV use. And yeah. I had it bad. I would use a vein light. Have you heard of a vein light? You hold it up to your skin so you can see the veins that are underneath. So
I would try to do that with a cell phone, but I could never figure out how to make it work.
A flashlight, a really skinny, bright ass LED flashlight, hold it up to your skin. The whole area turns red and you can see the under vein.
Okay.
So what I did was I destroyed not only the veins that I could see, but also the veins underneath. And so I don't think you probably will be able to see it on camera, but I have a very deformed upper shoulder area because I started muscling it. And I got so many infections in my upper arms. I can't tell you how many times I had to go to the ER to have shit drained and how many doctors and nurses fucking judged me and treated me like shit. I had one doctor, they're supposed to numb it, wait till it gets numb before they cut it and then squeeze. He numbed it and not even 30 seconds later, cut it and started squeezing. I was like, oh wow. He's like, I'm almost done. I mean, it's almost like he wanted to punish me. Yeah, so that was when, like, I would shoot, you know, other people's old blood. I don't know if you saw the post, but I would dig through needle bins and, like, shoot other people's blood, you know, in a desperation to not be sick. I had a pretty fucking big habit. Like, I needed, like, at least 2 grams of heroin a day. And that shit is fucking expensive, you know? And it's super cut. Like, by the time it gets to Hawaii, it is stopped on so many times that it's, like, not even real anymore.
How does it get to Hawaii? I mean, there must be the biggest droughts ever in Hawaii. How does it even get there? I mean, people bring it in planes? That's because they don't make it there, right?
Boats, planes. Yeah, no, a lot of it comes from Mexico. One time I came back with 6 grams and like, I honestly just had it in my purse tucked into like a pill bottle. Sometimes they just don't check. I don't know.
Yeah.
I also, one of my dealers though got caught with a kilo. And he went to prison and fucking killed himself in there. He hung himself.
Oh,
he was probably in his 60s. Dude, I have a funny story to tell about him. His wife was like schizophrenic. And one day I was like over there and I was like, man, everyone's always like saying that they don't like me. And I fit. And she's like, well, have you heard your voice? I was like, what? She's like, well, you want them to tell you why they don't like you. Have you heard your voice? And I was like, you know what? I like you. I like that shit. You know,
she was fucking funny.
It was funny. I'm like, how come the only man who can actually be real with me is the one with schizophrenia? But my nose is just super like skinny and all it's all collapsed. So I got that nasal voice, but it's okay. So yeah, that was when I got the sepsis and the osteomyelitis and the endocarditis from shooting other people's blood and letting abscesses go untreated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so fucking dangerous to not have antibiotics for an abscess. And so, yeah, I mean, it started like 3 weeks before that. I started feeling a pain in my back and it got worse at night. It would kind of go away during the day. I honestly and truly didn't think that it had anything to do with any of my abscesses. You know what I mean? Like back pain. Okay, well, turns out one night I had a fever really bad. Like I felt it. It just came on. I was doing dates like this too, and I couldn't even stand up straight. I was hunched over. Like every movement, I was just like, oh my God, it hurts so fucking bad. I'd go down to do a date. I just hurry up and get this over with. You know, take my $80 and go or whatever. I mean, I would do cheap fucking fast car dates for like $80. But yeah, so I called an ambulance on myself because I knew that something was wrong. And when they picked me up, I just remember them taking my temperature and it was 102.7. And when I got to the ER, it took hours, it felt like, to find a vein. All the lab techs tried, all the nurses tried, and then they asked the doctor to try. And he bent me back on the table. They literally took my bed and leaned it back so I was leaning back and the blood would flow to my head so he could try and go in my neck. And he couldn't find my neck vein. That's how destroyed. I still, to this day, when I make my angry face, you can't see any veins that pop out. And so he had to take an ultrasound and go in my femoral area because I was also using my femoral vein. That's like a last resort for addicts too. It's so fucking dangerous to shoot up there. And so I remember him digging around in there and it was so fucking painful because there's nerves down there. And he was able to get an IV started there. So at that point, they figured out that I had endocarditis in my heart. And I had osteomyelitis in my spinal cord, which is basically like staph inside of your bone. And so regular antibiotics don't treat it very well. You have to be on like vancomycin and the IV antibiotics. And so most people, they would send them home with a PICC line. And then the person would have to come back every day. But I was not a candidate for that for obvious reasons. And so they said I had to stay hospitalized for 6 weeks. But when I was in the ER, after they got the vein started, everything, they went to take me for an MRI. And I don't know if you've ever had one, but the table is so fucking hard and you're going to like a little hole and they have a button to press for claustrophobia if you get anxious. And so I started to get anxious and press the button. And I remember as soon as I got out, I sat up as fast as I could and I felt this searing fucking pain in my back. And then I woke up 5 days later and my parents were there. The doctor had called them and said, you should probably come out here because your daughter's really sick and she's probably not going to make it.
Oh, and my so gosh.
Told them to come out and like just be prepared. And he also said that if I did survive, that I was going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life just because of where the infection was in my spine. And so nobody thought, honestly, it was scary. But when I woke up, I don't really remember anything. But I do remember after 10 days, pulling everything out of my arms and leaving. For the next 8 months, I went to the ICU 4 more times. I got kicked out of and banned from the hospital because I was trying to fight the security guard because I knew that I was really sick and I knew I needed to be in ICU. So I always tried to go out and hustle as much as I could so I could go in there with a lot of heroin, because I still needed to use while I was there. Right. I'd have people sit into me.
Okay, and so because you would get sick is what you're saying. So that's why you wouldn't stay for them to treat you. It's because you would start to get dope sick.
You know what's funny too is they would give me stuff too. I was going to say,
wouldn't they give you some stuff?
They were giving me Dilaudid, like 2 million.
Okay, but it wasn't enough.
And okay, this is the last like story that I want to tell you because I honestly and truly don't think your followers are even going to believe me. But the second time that I went to the hospital, Straub, they were like, well, here you are again. It was like maybe the third time. You're here again, Christina. Why should we admit you if you're just going to leave? And I said, I'm going through withdrawal. Like I'm kicking a bunch of shit. Like I need to be properly medicated for my withdrawal. So the doctor comes in, a woman, and she's like, she was actually really nice. And she's like, what can we give you that you will feel comfortable? And I'm like, okay, well, let me be reasonable here. You know, I was like, well, 2 milligram Dilaudid is not enough. I mean, if you guys could do 4 every 4 hours and Ativan every 4 hours. And she said, okay. She's like, all right, we'll do it. And I still fucking left.
Oh, still shit. Fucking left. Okay. Ugh.
I didn't even end up doing the full 6 weeks in the hospital. I have no idea to this day how the infection was able to clear. I think it's just from all the different times that I did take antibiotics. But I definitely am a miracle and should not be here because it was life-threatening for sure.
Is that when you leave?
No, that was in 2016. And so when I woke up, parents said, you know, once they knew that I was okay and I was alive, they flew back to California and took my dog with them. I didn't tell you that when I was with Austin, we got a puppy named Major. And so he stayed with me. And so he lived on the streets with me. He slept with me in the tent and everything. Little cute little fucker.
That's why your Instagram is Major Christina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so my parents came and took him back, thinking that once I got better, I would follow. But I didn't. It took me another 4 years of using, you know, health problems. I was doing so much meth that I was starting to develop congestive heart failure. My ankles would swell up like tree trunks. I would have a really hard time breathing. And so I went to the doctor and she told me, you have a heart murmur. You know, you need to stop the drugs. And the turning point for me was in June of 2020. Well, actually, it would have been back in April or May. I had an abscess. Really bad one. Had to go to the ER. I was trying to numb it and lance it at home. I actually had lidocaine. As I drew up lidocaine, tried to numb it, and then tried to cut it. I just couldn't cut deep enough because I was scared and it hurt. So I went to the ER, and the doctor came in, and I had done a UA and stuff. He's like, well, I just wanted to say that, you know, congrats, you are pregnant. I was like, what? What? Well, he said, congratulations. And I said, for what? My abscess? And he was like, well, no, you're pregnant. And I was like, what? And it turns out I was 4 months along.
Holy shit.
I thought I was just fat. I honestly did. But I did notice that like my boobs had gotten bigger, but I don't get a period. I had never got a period. All the years of doing heroin, it took my period away. So the only man that I had been sleeping with was one of my customers, Roy. He was a customer the entire time I was there. He was another Fred type figure, helped me a lot, but he wanted to have sex with me. And that's okay, whatever. He was a Hawaiian man. So our baby would have been half white and half Hawaiian.
Oh, Christina,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Just take a beat. Just breathe. It's okay. Take your time. Take your time. It's okay.
Okay, sorry. So I went to Planned Parenthood and they told me I was 16 weeks along and they scheduled an abortion for me. They told me that it was going to feel like, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. No, take your time. It's okay. We have plenty of time. Also, side note, I am so fucking proud of you and impressed. I can't believe as we sit here, you have 3 years. I don't know how you survived and how you got clean. I don't know how you did it. And I'm so proud of you. I can't believe you're here. I'm so impressed by you in your life and your strength. You take your time. It's okay. I'm so proud of you.
They scheduled me for an abortion and my dad paid for the Uber for me. I was living at Fred's apartment and they didn't give me any like Xanax or Valium or anything like they would a normal because I'm an addict and it was obvious. And so they performed it without any like meds and they told me that it was gonna feel like period cramps. To this day, I haven't felt anything as painful of that as that in my entire life. And so I was screaming bloody murder for them to stop. She stopped for a second and I could the sound of the vacuum. She stopped for a second and she said, okay, are you okay? And then the nurse held my hand. I said, okay, okay, go. And she turned it back on and it was unbearable. It was the most worst pain I've ever felt in my life. And so I told her to stop. I said, stop. I can't take it. Stop. Stop. Please stop. Stop. And so she said, we're only halfway done, honey. And I said, I can't do this. I need some kind of anesthesia or medicine. It hurts too bad. And so they sent me home that night with a diaper on. And then I went back the next day and they put me under anesthesia. And so I didn't realize it was as traumatizing as it was until much later because I just went home and did more heroin. But me and my parents had already been talking about bringing me home. They were trying to bring me home for, they only did that tough love, like you're stuck out there shit for maybe 3 years. But like after Austin and everything, they wanted me to come home. I didn't want to because I didn't want to stop using. And so from 23 to 30, I just used and used. And so in 2020, after I had the abortion and everything, they scheduled a flight for me and I planned to come home and get on methadone. And so it's funny because I missed a few flights. Like they had to keep rebooking it because I would miss them. So I packed all my things and I said goodbye to Fred. And I knew it deep in my soul that it was going to be the last time I saw him. He was an older man. He was in his 60s at this point. He had health problems. And so he said a prayer over me. And I do have a video of that. And I have it on my page, but it's not him talking. It's music in the background. He prayed over me. And then I left and my parents picked me up from the airport and I moved in with them and I got on methadone. And I tried really hard to do the right thing. I didn't have any connects, but I did come home with stuff. And I also told my parents, I'm like, it's going to take a while before I'm actually stable on my dose. Like, I need to keep using for a little while. And so what I manipulated my parents into is I was like, Dad, I know where to get methadone on the streets, like pills. And so I can supplement that. And he actually believed me. And so he gave me $300 and took me down to Poway to my best friend Kimmy's house. She's the one I just posted the baptism of. And she's doing really, really good now, too. I'm so freaking proud of her. But I went down to her house and she had to connect and fucking hooked me up with a bunch of heroin. And so for my first few weeks home, I was doing heroin and going up on my dose, titrating up. I pushed myself all the way up to 170. And it was after I went to the women's meeting for the first time and I got a sponsor and I told her, you know, that I was still using and I had needles in my purse. She's like, well, that's it. Today's the day. Like, you're out. And at this point I was on a really high dose of methadone, so I wasn't going to feel any withdrawals. So she cleaned my purse out and shit. I was clean from September of 2020 to March of 2021. I was doing outpatient on Zoom at a program called New Leaf. And then I was just taking my methadone. And one night in March, I also got involved with a really fucking shady guy. Of course, I always go with guys that still live at home with their mom, with no job, with tattoos, like just because I have a cute face, you know? It's so annoying. But anyways, I got with him and I actually really liked him. Once again, my standards for men just, he was a fucking loser. He was on probation for beating up his girlfriend. You know what I mean? So it's like, I just had, my picker was off. My parents hated that I was seeing him. But anyways, I wasn't using with him or anything. I was just on methadone. So I had Christmas there and stuff. And I feel terrible now looking back. I was like, fuck, that was my first Christmas home after 10 years. And I told my parents I wanted to spend it with this guy, you know? And so he ended up cheating on me after a month and a half. And it really, really hurt. But through the women that I knew and everything, they were just like, you can't take that. Like, just dump him. So I fucking dumped him, blocked him on everything. It hurt for about a month. And then I started slowly getting over it. And then in March, I was on Instagram one night and I was scrolling through people's stories. And I saw this one girl. She's part of like a biker club group and she's super pretty. And they were all at a bar drinking and they all cheers. Woo! And they took the shots at the same time. And I was like, you know what? I can fucking drink. Like, fuck. I'm so sick of being sober. And so I went and took 4 shots of my parents' Bacardi. I was shooting fentanyl and meth that night.
Oh my gosh.
That night. As soon as I got drunk. Well, this fucking feels good, but I want the real shit, you know? And so I only used for 1 month. That cracked out video of me that I use a lot in my posts, that was me before I got clean this last time. So I only used for about a month, but it got bad fast. I mean, I was babysitting for my cousin's family and they fired me. My parents changed the locks at home. I lost everything very quickly again. And so my Aunt Carol came and got me and put me into the psych ward at Palomar, where I was for 5 days. I just don't remember much except other than sleeping because I was up for days on meth. And then I went to the crisis house in Escondido for 2 weeks. My mom is mad at this point. And she's, you know, bringing me my clothes. And when she came to visit me, you know, you're not coming home, right, Christina? You know, that was your one chance and you fucked it up. So you're on your own now. And they were still wanting to support me, but it's like, I just had to do it on my own. And so I went to Serenity House and I was there for 4 months. I used a few times while I was there, you know, because I am very impulsive. It's like when I get that urge to use, it's like I feel like I don't have any other option. And so I used a few times while I was there, but because I wasn't court ordered or anything, I was just self-referred. Like, they gave me chances, but I did graduate. And then I was going to go to sober living, but I stayed at my parents' for about a month before there was a bed open. And it was during that period that I got the phone call that Fred had died. He overdosed in the apartment that we lived in together. And there was Narcan in the bathroom with him on the shelf. And there was Narcan on our fridge. We had a bunch of Narcans in the house. And so there was another girl living there with him. She was living with us when I left. And so I told her, this man is very dear to my heart and I need you to take care of him. You know, at this point, I'm helping Fred take his medicine. I'm almost like his caretaker in a way. Oh, and I will add that at some point, Fred's baby's mother died and then his girlfriend died.
Oh, wow.
And so he and me were just so depressed and we just stuck together. and used together. When I would go to jail, he would bail me out. The only money that he got every month was Social Security. And then because he was a veteran and he got injured, he got some money from the military too. But it wasn't much. It was maybe like $2,500 a month. But he would always look out for me. And at one point, him and my dad had a phone relationship, and my dad would send him money to help with the rent. And I was telling my parents that I was like doing good and shit. But anyway, so the girl that was living with him, you know, promised me that she was going to take care of him. And so when she called me that night, I was like, where were you? She's like, I was in the living room. He was in there with the door closed. I'm like, how long was he in there with the door closed? You know what I mean? And so I'm angry at her, and she has blocked me on everything. And my other friends that still live there in Hawaii that are homeless message me, and they're like, you know, we could still see the apartment, and April is still there, and now she has her boyfriend there. Some people were saying that she intentionally let it happen so that she could have the apartment. And so I don't know what happened, and I didn't get to go to a funeral. I didn't get to go to a celebration of life. So there's a lot of like grief there that has not gotten any closure. And I would love to be able to go to Waikiki and like visit his grave and stuff. Oh, and then another thing, 2 months after he died, his sister, who I've never talked to, she's a square, messaged me on Facebook and said, I just found out that Fred's body has been sitting at the morgue for 2 months. What is going on? So I called April and I just couldn't get an answer. The cops took him, but nobody did what was needed to do so that he could get buried. And Fred was so cute. He paid every month for funeral insurance. It was like $30 a month or something. Because he always said, when I die, I want to have a headstone, you know, in the pretty graveyard or whatever. And so he had that plan set up. And so when his sister messaged me that, the hurt and the anger I was just so mad. And I still have not gotten to talk to her, like on the phone or anything. And she's just avoiding me like crazy. So that happened when I was about 30 days clean. And I'm pretty sure that is why I'm still clean.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure, because I have not used then. I've been clean since then.
So, okay. Did they let you stay at Serenity House on methadone?
Yeah,
I didn't know that. Okay, that's new. They didn't used to let you do that. So you've been clean ever since. What's your date? What's your sobriety date?
August 19th, 21. While I was in there, a few impulses like, fuck, I want to use. And I did know one person. So I had them drop something off at the gate and I sent them. It's like, it didn't even get me high. It's almost like it was just pointless.
Right.
But yeah.
August 19th. Wow. So you have just over 2 years.
Yep, just over 2 years. And I was going weekly at the clinic. I had to go, no, first I got 3 take home, so I had to go twice a week. And then I got 1 week, so I had to go once a week. And then, since I've been clean, I've tapered from 172 milligrams to 21 milligrams.
This is insane. This is why I wanted to have you on. You are a successful methadone story. You are a success. And I think that it's so underrated as a form of recovery and I'm so glad that when you went to that women's meeting, I'm so proud of whoever's there, that nobody made you feel like you couldn't be there on methadone. I know that some people in 12-step have given you a hard time though, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but you have found people that sponsor you and are fine with it. Because I saw you were at an NA retreat and I was like, oh good, she's going on retreats with 12-step people.
That's our women's retreat for the Ladies Book of Choice meeting. I've known those girls now since 2020. I still go to that meeting and it's still my home group. Everybody knows who Katie is. She's a little Katie in Oceanside. Fuck, I forget her last name. But she's the one that always puts, you know, the yearly round, not the roundup, but the thing up in the camping, you know, the camping in September that everybody does. It's like a big AA event for the weekend.
If it's AA, I don't know it probably.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. I don't know as much.
It puts it on.
So okay. Okay.
It's like God knew who I needed.
Yes.
And needed. And it's just, and listen to this too. I met Bradley 4 days after Fred died.
Oh my gosh.
It's like God took Fred and then placed Bradley in my life. It's just crazy to me how much my higher power is acting in my life, you know? And has acted in my life.
So let me ask you this. Do you think, because at the level that you were using for 10 years with all of the trauma and everything that happened to you, I feel like methadone was necessary for you versus a detox, cold turkey, and then you just are raw dog in life after 10 fucking years. Do you agree with that? Yeah, you couldn't have done it is what you're saying.
No, I couldn't. And, you know, I did try other ways. I had tried Suboxone and, you know, I knew cold turkey was just never going to be an option for me. I today have no problem saying that. I cannot handle opiate withdrawal. I can't. And I'm not going to let myself feel it and then put myself in a position where I have to go sleep with someone or something.
Exactly.
But it's different now. Now I have, like, you know, money saved. I have a lot of money saved. I've got money in the bank and shit. So
totally.
If I were to realize that, it would be terrible.
Well, but like, okay, so the methadone allowed you to regulate your fucking life is my, you know what I mean? It allows you to regulate your life and start to learn what it looks like to be you, the beautiful girl in front of me who can share her story and doesn't have to live on the streets and fucking get beat up and have all of this trauma. It allowed you to do that. So what has the taper looked like for you from 170 to 21? How long has that taken? How often do you do it? How do you feel? And how are you managing the levels down as you have them?
I go down every time I go to the clinic. When I was on such a high dose, I could do, you know, 7 to 5 milligram jumps without feeling anything.
Okay.
And so beginning, I would go down maybe 7 or 5 at a time. And then once I got to like probably 90 is when I started to feel it. I was working at Target. My first job in recovery was at Target. I worked in the beauty department and I was living at Sober Living. And so that was when Bradley was living at the male Sober Living. I was living at the female Sober Living and we would go to meetings together. And then he was working at the Duncan warehouse and I was working at Target. And those were our starter jobs. And he saved and I saved. And yeah, I mean, then we, but as far as the methadone, yeah. So at 90, I would say I started to feel it. I would be at work at Target and I would be like freezing and sweating a little bit. But my thinking is this, when we do heroin, even though I like to have 2 grams a day, I don't need 2 grams a day to be well. I only needed maybe like 3 points, like point maybe. I can make that last all day and stay well. So that's how I've looked at this. Like, I'm getting some methadone. It's not like I don't have any in my system. So whenever I start to feel like a little bit of withdrawal, I'm like, you're not even withdrawing. You still have methadone in your system. And so that's kind of what keeps me going. And another thing is the symptoms, like, don't last long. Like, I'll get a runny nose for an hour and then it will go away. Or I'll get chills and cold sweats for an hour and then it'll go away. I would say the main symptom that I've had is disrupted sleep. I think that's pretty like normal and for opiate addicts. I have been trying a bunch of different, you know, mental health meds and stuff. Like I have Seroquel here for sleep, but ideally I do not take it because it makes me very hungry and I'm a recovering bulimic and, you know, binge eater. I've worked really hard to like lose this weight. And so any medicine that makes me hungry is not conducive to my recovery. And even methadone makes me crave sugar. So that's another reason why I like want to get off of it. But I think, you know, it started getting hard around like 50. I kept holding on to the fact, but you know what? You still have some methadone in your system. So stop. Like, you're fine.
What is your plan? How far are we? 20 to zero? Or are you going to stay at 20? What do you want to do?
I'm going down 1 every 2 weeks. So okay. if I can commit to that and get through it, I want to start a family. That is my goal. I want to be a mom. I want to have a kid with Bradley. He is 49. My boyfriend's 49. He's 15 years older than me. And so that is kind of putting me a little bit into rush mode.
Okay.
Like, I know that I can have kids until I'm probably 40 or so, but mm-hmm. I don't want, he's already going to be an older dad.
Right.
I don't want him to be like a grandpa dad.
Right.
You know? And so that is my motivation. That's it right there. I don't have kids and I want kids. I feel like women have that internal instinct to like want to mother something. And I have a lot of love to give. And, you know, Bradley, I take really good care of him. And we are so, you know, what's crazy is his first job was at Duncan. Now he's working as a manager at a co-occurring psychiatric institute called Crown View. He's like one of the house managers there now. He's getting paid $6 more than he was at Duncan. me, I'm getting paid $6 more than I was at Target, you know, at my new job.
And what is your new job? Also, I have a stupid question. I have a really stupid question. You can't get pregnant on methadone? Obviously. Is that obvious?
No, you can. I just...
But then the baby gets it, right? The baby has to withdraw when they're born or something. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
And I
which you don't want to do,
that.
Obviously, which I understand. Yeah. Okay. I honestly didn't know what the answer to that question was. So what is your job now? Because you do something super cool. Also, again, I want to interject this. I know I said this when you were getting emotional. I'm so proud of you. I'm so impressed. I don't know how you got out of that shit that you were in. That's one of the gnarliest stories I've ever heard of life, like a person living, and you're so young. I can't believe you got out. I can't believe you broke that cycle. You lived, you're here, and you have 2 years. I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed. I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you did this.
If it was just me, like trying to do it on my own, I wouldn't have been able to, but God knew exactly what I needed. And like, He has blessed me with just so many things. And like I would say from January to May or April of this year, I was really, really depressed. I was having cravings. I was probably around like the 30 milligram range. I was working at, okay, so between Target and where I work now, I worked at Paragon, which is a program in Fallbrook. They're a more of like a bougie place. They don't take Medi-Cal. It's a couples program. So they take couples. And I worked the night shift. I was graveyard from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Oh, I forgot. Graveyards too. So for almost a year, him and I were doing graveyard shifts. I put 30 pounds back on. I couldn't sleep when I needed to, but would always sleep when I couldn't sleep. Like I was always tired at work, but as soon as I would get home in the morning, it's like brain just would go into manic mode. And so I got super irregulated and out of it. And I started trying different mental health meds. I got on Effexor, which was a horrible, made me worse. It made me so angry. But another thing I started around April or like May is EMDR therapy. And so since then, I have had like 3 or 4 like episodes is what we call them, me and my boyfriend. Like one in particular, I was just very upset and emotional. And then we went to the Vista Pub and we were waiting for the waiter to come to get our drinks. And I just felt the urge to cry. Like, I was like, I can't stop it. I can't stop it. It's coming. So I ran out to the car and you know, the kind of crying you can do when no one's there. You don't give a fuck about how you look. If there's not, I was wailing crying. And I kept telling him, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I thought it was a bad thing. I was like, I am miserable. I'm depressed. I'm going to fail him. But that was like God letting me heal, because that's happened like 3 times. And all those years, I did not cry. Like at a certain point, I became like gangster Tina. I was like, nah, you ain't gonna fuck with me, you know? And I had a really hardened attitude. I did not cry, but I believe that this therapy has truly helped me, you know, release. Oh my God, it's 11:43. Oh my God, I have to be at work at noon.
Oh shit. Okay. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. All right. Okay.
Oh my God, I'm so fired. Okay. Well, I love you so much.
I love you too. I love you too. When are you done with work?
At 8:30. Oh my God.
Okay. All right. Go. We'll talk later.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye.